This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Syria is in the middle of a global power play between the United States and Russia. The chain of events which led to the U.S. military strikes this month was set off by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, coming from a political family. He was elected in 2000 and since backed by Russia, the Assad government's choice to use force in response to mass protests that began there in 2011, escalated to a deadly chemical attack there on April the 4th. Professor David Lesh is the author of Syria, the Fall of the House of Assad. He was well acquainted with the embattled president and explains how the foreign interests there continue to cross with the conflicts in the Middle East. Phone lines are open if you've got a question or a comment as we talk about Syria this half hour. Call in 210-614-8980. And David Lesh, welcome back to The Source. Great to have you
here. Good to be here, David.
So can you help me understand, is there a coherent U.S. policy towards Syria?
There is no coherent policy towards Syria from the Trump administration right now. Essentially, it is a holdover from the Obama administration policy, which over the last few years, despite the rhetoric, basically has accepted Syrian President Bashar al-Assad as a fait accompli, that he's, you know, the least worst evil, that him falling from power would be worse in terms of who might take over or the chaos that might incur in a power vacuum in Syria. And the Trump administration, despite recent actions, I think has adopted that. Now, whether they massage that more, we don't know. Obviously, they've established a red line with regard to the use of chemical weapons with their cruise missile attack last week. And now, where that goes from here, we don't know. But you know, really, that was a slap on the wrist. That was a very targeted, measured attack that was meant to send a specific signal toward chemical or for the Syrian regime not to use chemical weapons again, but not in any way, shape, or form meant to undermine or overthrow the Syrian regime.
How comfortable are you in believing that that chemical weapon attack was delivered by the Syrian government?
Well, it either was delivered by the Syrian government, ordered directly or indirectly by Assad, delivered by Syrian government by a rogue element of the Syrian military. It was a fabrication, as President Bashar al-Assad said the other day, happened as the Russians have said, that the Syrian government carried an attack that accidentally hit a warehouse full of chemical weapons owned and operated by al-Qaeda affiliated elements in Syria. Of those four, I would be leaning toward the Syrian government ordering the attack and Assad, at least indirectly, if not directly, knowing about it, simply because despite the fact that the Assad regime does not have as much command and control over their armed forces as they used to have all over the country, they do, of all the branches of the Syrian military, it's the Air Force over which they do have significant command and control. And, we may never be able to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, but certainly the preponderance of the evidence suggests that that's what happened. However, I really hope that in the future, the Trump administration response seemed like a convulsive reflex of response. Now, we are not privy to the intelligence they had. They seem pretty sure, pretty confident that Syrian government forces carried it out in the way they described. But, one would hope that such military action is the product of more deliberation and analysis and possibly even an investigation to show, who exactly carried out the attack.
Syria was supposed to give up its stockpile of chemical weapons. So now we know they did not. They still retained another supply then, right?
If they did carry out this attack, then yes. The they kept some chemical weapons or precursors to chemical weapons following the agreement in 2013, which most people think, and even the Israelis were on board with that because the agreement diminished or took away or almost eliminated more Syrian chemical weapons than any military strike could have done. But everyone was always a bit skeptical. Did the Syrian government keep some of the weapons, or did they keep some of the precursors and were able to create the weapons, later on during the war?
And so whose failure is that we were not able to get rid of all of Syria's chemical weapons? Of course, there was a previous, under the Obama administration, a chemical weapons attack on the civilians This caused a lot of anguish around the world. We got to do something about this. Russia stepped up and they brokered a deal, which they were able to remove those chemical weapons, and then the United States was able to destroy them or render them inert offshore. So what happened?
I think, and the Trump administration is pointing the blame at the Russians, and I think that's probably correct. They're the ones that desperately wanted to broker that agreement to forestall a U.S. Strike. So it's really, you know, they own the agreement. It's their responsibility to implement the terms of the agreement with their client state, with the Syrian government. And I can't imagine the Russians are at all happy about the fact that if indeed the Syrian government carried out that that this happened, because it allowed the Trump administration, the U.S., to enter into the situation more directly than the Russians wanted. It complicates the U.S.-Russian relationship with regard to their objective to diminish the Islamic State and degrade the Islamic State. And it complicates what Russia really wants in Syria, and that's a political settlement.
And why did Syria then tip their hand, show the world they have chemical weapons, and then use them on a civilian target, knowing that it probably would have produced the result that we got?
Yeah. Again, if Assad ordered it or indirectly ordered it, or, you know, obviously he's responsible for it if the Syrian government carried it out, you know, it's an arrogant act in my view. It's an overconfident act. You know, from his vantage point, you know, the Trump administration a week beforehand, there were some comments from top administration figures saying basically that we're accepting Assad, that we have no other choice. In one way or another, they were saying that. To Assad, they view that, I think, as a green light. They see the province of Idlib, which is a safe haven for opposition elements and is dominated by the Al-Qaeda-affiliated opposition group in Syria. They see the Russians hit Idlib province. They've seen the U.S. hit Idlib province. So they figure that all's fair.
So, I mean, it sounds like you're saying that when Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, said, I think we're fine with Assad, that was the green light that he was waiting for in order to unleash his chemical weapons on his own civilians.
Not so much waiting for it, but I think it reinforced a view and it gave him more confidence to carry out an attack like this. I think absolutely there's a direct line to this, because that's how the Syrian regime has seen the world for some time, even before the 2011 uprising began, is that if the U.S. wanted him out, he'd be out. That's how they view the capabilities of the U.S. They've seen what's happened in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in Libya. When the U.S. wants someone gone, they're gone. So in this reductionist view of the world, from their point of view, if he's not gone, that means the U.S. therefore wants him to stay, despite all this. And in fact, I believe, knowing Assad as much as I do and the way the Syrian regime sees the world, is that the slap on the wrist with the cruise missile strike reinforced that narrative that the U.S. wants Assad to continue. Because if they didn't, that was an opportunity to do much, much more, and the U.S. did not.
We're going to take a quick break. Our phone lines are open if you've got a question or a comment as we talk about the background of Syria and where we are now with the United States in a power play over this critical Middle Eastern nation with Russia. Questions that are remaining, you know, there is a border between Syria and Israel, another border between Syria and Turkey. Turkey just had a big election this weekend, which would strengthen the president's power there. Will that change things there? There are already American boots on the ground in Syria. What does that mean for our level of involvement in that country? Give us a call if you got a question, 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the studio, Professor David Lesh. He's author and Ewan Housel Distinguished Professor of History at Trinity University. His book is Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. It came out in September of 2012, and a lot has changed since that book came out.
Yeah, in fact, I had to update it in 2013, but it have to be updated three or four more times since then.
Right, but even when your book came out, you were kind of like saying Assad is someone we could work with.
I said that of all the scenarios that Assad... him staying in power, although, you know, for many people, not desirable, but that was probably going to be the case because, you know, I understood, I think, how Syria works and that he had, you know, they're kind of coup-proof and they have the wherewithal and the sink or swim together mentality To stay in power. And fortunately or unfortunately, depending what side you are, he still is in power, and I think he will be for at least a few years to come.
And in 2012, Damascus was still a thriving city full of art and literature and poetry and people having, living very fulfilling lives. And now that's not the case. You wrote in the New York Times in January a piece about what to do with Syria and Assad now. And you say he won, but he won basically a pile of rubble.
Yeah, over much of the country. Damascus is actually one of the few places that's escaped some of the destruction, although, on the edges and in some areas, it also has experienced some problems. But, what has Assad, what has he won? You have, over 500,000 people killed. You have half the population displaced either internally or externally, $300 billion of reconstruction to do. And where is he going to get the money? The Russians and the Iranians don't have it. He's going to want it from the West and some of the Arab Gulf states who really don't want him to continue in power. So there's some leverage there. And he certainly has to engage in dramatic political reform if he ever hopes to get some reconstruction aid.
So is his greatest fear probably the third option where Russia and the United States can agree on someone else taking the reins of Syria, someone not Assad, who would basically be friendly to Russia, provide stability, and end the civil war?
I think he's worried about that. I mean, the Russians have been telling me for years, ever since the beginning of the crisis, that they're not wedded to Assad. I was just in Moscow this past December, and the Russians were telling me, we know that Syria cannot be a stable entity into the future with Assad remaining in power because he's too divisive of a figure. He's a polarizing figure. Too much blood has been spilled. And so I think if they could get a transition away from him while maintaining their geostrategic interest in Syria, that would be the ideal scenario. For the Russians. It's not going to be anytime soon because, the first line they say after saying we'd not wedded to him is that we have nowhere else to go. He's the only horse on which we can ride.
Let's go to the caller. Michael has called in. And Michael, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
I was wondering, does our country have the manpower to back up another shooting war anywhere in the world? It would seem to me if we start shooting anywhere else in Syria or in Korea, we're not going to have the manpower to do it, and we'd have to draft up an army to do it. And I think that would just finish off any president who was in office. And I'll be happy to take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Michael. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 210-614-8980 to call in. And so that may be out of your direct area of expertise, David Lish. But what do you think?
Well, I think the caller is correct. I don't think the American public has, I don't want to say the stomach for it, but, has the staying power to enter into another Middle East war. I mean, Obama essentially won in the 2008 election for a number of different reasons, one of which, was that he was promised to get out of Middle East wars and not to get into any more of them. And that really was a staple of his foreign policy with regard to Syria. I think the same with Trump, and I don't think the public would support significant boots on the ground in a place like Syria where it could be a slippery slope toward a quagmire a la Iraq.
Yeah, Donald Trump, when he was running for president, was saying, why do we care about Syria? Let them all fight it out. What doesn't make any difference to us? But it does make a difference to Russia. Mm-hmm. Russia cares about Syria. Why?
Well, geostrategic interests. It's their only naval base at the city of Tartus on the Mediterranean, in the whole Mediterranean area. They have now, since their assertive intervention in September 2015, built up an air base in Latakia, also on the Mediterranean coast. This is their area of ingress into the Middle East now. They've reestablished themselves as a power to be reckoned with in the Middle East, and it's a vehicle through which Putin has been able to assert his sort of global authority and global power and his positioning vis-a-vis the United States.
So while the United States may not care that much about Syria, Russia would be willing to go to the mattresses for Syria in a big way.
They already have, and even more than Russia, Iran has gone to the mattresses. And this is one of the things I think that the Obama administration and Trump also realize, and Trump's advisors are telling him this, is that Syria is much more important to Iran than Russia. If we up the ante in Syria, they're just going to up it that much more. And where does that go? It's a spiraling, it's a spiral toward much more involvement in a quagmire.
So how important is it to the United States, though, to keep Iran out of taking over Syria because it is right on the border with Israel and there's the dispute over the Golan Heights?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything the U.S. Can do about it. Iran is there. We kind of, in the Obama administration, acquiesced to the Iranian presence in Syria because for us to move in assertively in Syria, arm the opposition, or try to overthrow Assad in any sort of meaningful way, that would upset the Iranians and that would have scuttled the legacy-making piece of Obama's foreign policy, and that was the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal, or the West-Iran nuclear deal. And it was very clear that Obama was holding back because he didn't want to scuttle that deal. So the Iranians are there, and that worries the Israelis quite a bit. I mean, particularly because not only Iranian presence, but even more so their support for Hezbollah, the Party of God, the Shiite Islamist group in Lebanon that is supported by Iran and also is fighting for Assad in Syria. And for the Israelis, their top foreign policy threat from their perspective is, you know, three things: Hezbollah, Hezbollah, and Hezbollah. And so they want to very much make sure, and they've taken actions already, military actions, to make sure that neither Iran, its Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps, or Hezbollah set up any sort of presence in the Golan Heights or near the Golan Heights. And there have been some military strikes against their interests.
So if things go really bad in Syria, could it be an existential threat to Israel?
You know, it's interesting. The Israelis, they want to make sure that Iran doesn't end up on its border, in essence, in Syria. And they're very worried that since Assad is so beholden to Iran for basically saving him, even more than the Russians, over the course of this whole civil war in Syria, that he'll be more eager to make concessions and allow for more of an Iranian presence in Syria. And that worries the Israelis.
Let's go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980 with Samuel. And Samuel, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Yes, good afternoon, that is. I spent 4 years over in that area and went to George Washington University for Arab-Israeli conflict classes. And I was thinking that perhaps this is more opportunist or advantage to the Israelis if Syria is, let's say, the IDF provocate something that would allow the IDF to take over and occupy Syria. Well, the greater Israel plan of expansion would be able to put the Palestinian people in Gaza and in the West Bank up into Syria so they can have more Israeli settlements built in those two areas. And I think that that Russia and as well as Iran understand that the possibility of a land grab by the Israelis.
Okay.
I think Syria would be a great land grab for them.
Okay, Samuel, that's an interesting point. We're going to cut and take that apart. Thank you so much for that call. And so is that part of the calculus?
The Israelis don't have any interest, as far as I know, in moving into Syria, primarily because they would have to confront Iran, and more primarily, they'd have to confront the Russians right now.
It'd be an expensive land grab.
It'd be a very expensive and costly land grab. They just want to make sure that their borders are secure on Lebanon and Syria. And, I was in Israel speaking to some of their top people a couple of years ago, and they're really split on this situation in Syria. You know, many were like, we wouldn't mind Assad staying in power because he's the devil we know, and we've had at least straightforward relations with him. We've negotiated potential peace agreements with him, although they weren't consummated. Versus chaos and versus instability and the unknown. And so, if Assad falls, what happens? There's chaos, instability. Perhaps a jihadist group may assert itself in Syria.
Which is dedicated to the destruction of Israel.
Right, yeah. So, these are the questions. And so I think, the Syrians are beginning to realize that Assad is going to be there. They've been working and cooperating with the Russians to make sure there's no conflict between the two. They're deconflicting between the two. And Netanyahu meets with Putin more, recently than he's met with the U.S. president.
So we have U.S. boots on the ground in Syria today. They are functioning as advisors and not exactly direct combatants, but they're there, quite a few.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing, we said earlier that Obama and the Trump administration don't want boots on the ground in Syria, but they are there. Not so much against the Syrian regime, obviously, but to fight ISIS and to degrade and hopefully take over the territory of the Islamic State. They're there, yes, as advisors. They've been involved in some conflict. They're getting more involved. This is probably my biggest fear right now in Syria, is that there's so many different armies in particularly northern Syria. You have Kurdish forces, you have Turkish forces, you have Syrian opposition forces, you have Al-Qaeda, you have Russia, you have the United States, all in the Syrian army, all in these little pockets facing off with each other. It's like it's like a checkers board. And, you know, the possibility or potential for mistake is very, very high, and that could unravel quickly.
And with Turkey, with their vote that they had this weekend, giving the president more power, that's bad news for anyone who is rooting for a Turkish state and the Kurds there, a Kurdish state. And so that's what does that mean for Syria?
Well, it means that Erdogan, the president of Turkey, feels perhaps, although he only won 51% of the vote, that he has a mandate to carry out his policies in northern Syria. And for Turkey, Syria is about the Kurds and the Kurds and the Kurds, preventing any sort of Kurdish state and trying to limit any sort of Kurdish autonomy that may affect Kurdish nationalist aspirations in Turkey itself. So it's they'll probably continue its policy. It's been unpopular, Turkey's Syria's policy, among many Turks and even those supporters of Erdogan. I think they have realized that Assad isn't going to go as they had hoped for in the beginning, and that they just need to secure their interests and their border in the north. That's where their focus is right now.
But we've been using bases in Turkey to attack Syria, and what does that mean?
Well, it means the relationship, this triangle between the Turks, the Russians, and the U.S. is very, very delicate. And the Turks are, you know, trying to take advantage of what they can get out of each of the superpowers in order to enhance their interests. But, you know, at the end of the day, I don't think they're going to break away from NATO or the United States. However, the United States, I think, has serious concerns over the domestic political situation in Syria following this election.
So
in
Turkey, excuse me. Over the past 30 minutes, we've been talking about how complicated and entrenched this problem is with the Syrian foreign policy. Do you have any sense that they have this level of awareness inside the Situation Room at the White House?
I don't think anyone anywhere has this sense of awareness. I mean, they look at the world in very Manichaean fashion, black and white, where, you know, the nuances and the ebbs and flows and eddies with which the, you know, that you have to navigate in a place like Syria are simply too complex to understand on a day-to-day basis. And so they're trying to develop, I think, an overall policy, which I think right now is just despite recent events, a continuation of the Obama administration's, and that, you know, we'll let the Russians do what they do. You know, we will focus on ISIS, let the Russians focus on trying to get a political settlement. If they get it, everyone will love the off-ramp out of this quagmire that will provide. In the meantime, we'll just grin and bear President Bashar al-Assad continuing in power in the near future.
But President Trump seems to revel in the launching of missiles. He certainly took great enjoyment out of having the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake in the world and being able to give the order in front of the Chinese prime minister and also telling the Russians before he even told Congress that this was going to happen. What does that say to you?
Well, it means this has, you know, the reasons why he launched this attack aren't, you know, don't have to do just with Syria, but domestic and international political considerations, showing strength to the Chinese while he's there vis-a-vis the situation in North Korea, showing that he's different from Obama and showing strength to the Russians.
Yeah, but we're seeing that Syria is so complex, so volatile, it's a tinderbox, but one wrong spark can set it off. We really want to be using that to send messages.
You don't want to light the fire to something so combustible.
All right, David Lesh, he's an author and a UN household distinguished professor of history at Trinity University. His book is The Fall of the House of Assad. David, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, David.
It was great talking with you. This is The Source. We'll be right back.